Brembo Red, High Performance Podcast.
Hi, everyone. This is Dan Sandberg from Brembo North America, and the Brembo Red team is on location in this episode. Well, not quite on location, because it's only about a mile and a half from our headquarters. Totally coincidence. Anyway, we're at the Concours d'Elegance of America. That is an auto celebration located in Plymouth, Michigan. They've been doing it for over 40 years here in the Detroit area. The Concours d'Elegance has been held at various locations across the Detroit metropolitan area. This year at the Inn of St. John's and its beautiful 27-hole golf course, showcasing vehicles from 1900 all the way up to today. Almost 300 beautiful cars here. Brembo's been a big supporter of this event for several years. We host the media, the supercar display. We have a beautiful hospitality tent. Great place to be on a beautiful Sunday. And this year, this event is really kind of special, right? It's one of the first open-air automotive celebrations in over a year. And after this pandemic, it is great to get out and look at some great-looking cars. And there's one more difference in this year's event. The Concours is now owned by Hagerty Insurance, which many of you may know as a company that specializes in insuring collectible cars. But today, I look at Hagerty as more of an automotive lifestyle company supporting car culture globally. And it's my pleasure to have as my first guest here at the Concours, McKeel Hagerty, CEO of Hagerty. McKeel, thanks for stopping by Brembo Red for what no doubt is a pretty busy week for you and the Hagerty team.
It's a pleasure to be here. And yes, I only wish I could control the weather.
You know, when your brand is powerful enough, you'll be able to control the weather. That should be the target.
I got to get busy.
You know, I think many of our listeners know the Hagerty name, especially if they have a collector or vintage car, as the first company you go to, really, to get insurance protection, right? So you really have made a name for yourself. But Hagerty is so much more now than just insurance, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I can't help and ask you, how did you get into this niche that you found yourself in? Were you a car guy at first? Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I've been a car person all my life. I grew up in a car collecting family. My dad was a business person, entrepreneur, had an insurance business, general insurance business. But, you know, he didn't entertain for business. He wasn't into sports. He just played with cars in the garage. And so, you know, for me, spending time with dad was spending time around cars, working on cars. And he had a tradition, which was with my older sisters and I, when we were young teenagers, we would pick out a car and restore it with him in the garage. And so that was just kind of a fun thing to do. And it was kind of in that era in the 70s for my sisters and the early 80s for me, where, you know, you didn't think about the economic value of cars. They were just cool old cars, fun to have, and it was this great project and satisfying to get to know them. And then the insurance business kind of grew up alongside, but it was very small. It was in the basement of our house. And we all kind of, as kids in the family, spent a little bit of time doing some of both, playing with cars. Wooden boats were a huge early part of the business as well, real small niche. Then I was in grad school, early 90s, terrible time, you know, a few years later to try to go in to do what I wanted to do, which was be a philosophy professor. And I will never forget, I was sitting in a class on Plato's Republic, if you can imagine, and I was taking notes and, you know, was kind of winding up towards the end of a semester. And I thought, wait a minute, I had this idea, kind of a flash, a, you know, bolt of lightning kind of thing. And it was, if we could turn the business into something that looked more like a club than just an insurance business, it would just change how we interacted with customers. And I did something I've never thought of doing before, which was I closed my notebook. I got up, walked out of class, and I dropped out of my doctoral program and moved back home from Boston to Northern Michigan and took the thing over. And now we do an awful lot of other things.
And some of those other things include purchasing car shows. So you've got the Greenwich Concours now. You have Amelia Island. You now have the Concours of America here in Plymouth, Michigan. Explain to me how that fits into that strategy.
We all kind of represent the car world, whether we think we do or not. And I'm sure you get the question all the time of, is the next generation going to be into cars at all? Or what about kids? And we've been really passionate about youth programs for years around car events. So youth judging programs, manual transmission training, all we've done model building contests and youth design programs, all sorts of things. And I think it kind of reached a fever pitch out in the media world when everybody thought that the world wasn't going to just be an electrified vehicle world, but an autonomous vehicle world. And it was about 2016-17 when the hype around autonomous vehicles was reaching its fever pitch. I was at a conference, and this guy stood up on stage and did this incredible presentation about the future of the world where all vehicles were autonomous. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go up and introduce myself and just tell him what I do and, you know, try to connect with this guy. And he looked me square in the eye and said, I'm going to put you out of business. I'm so sorry. Grabbed my arm. And he said, literally, you have to find something else to do. Everything you think you know about the car world is going away. Go find something else to do. And, you know, I consider myself to be fairly quick on my feet in a lot of things. And I was just blown away. For one thing, it was rude. Second thing is, I know something about this world that he didn't know, which is that, you know, there are certain vehicles and certain things around the car world that actually matter to people. And it's not just about the economic value or the utility value of driving to and from work. So we got really passionate about this at our business, and we decided we have a purpose, and our purpose is to save driving and car culture for future generations. And a big part of car culture is events, media events, experiences, all of that. It's not just about the cars. It's not just about what they're worth. We have some really cool cars here this weekend, like some that are just like kind of Mona Lisa type cars. And one of them is a 70 Challenger that was referred, it's often referred to as the Black Ghost. It's one we're honoring here this weekend. And it has this incredible personal story connected with it because it was sort of the secret street racer in Detroit back in that golden age of street racing, drag racing in downtown Detroit. And it was owned by a police officer who, by the way, handed out traffic tickets during the day, and at night he'd go out and beat the pants off of everybody drag racing this car. And what we're trying to, you know, in this audience filled up with people we were looking at, is to say, like, you know, our belief system as car people has got to be that that car means something a little bit more than other things next to it. You know, that its history and the story, it's not what it's worth. It doesn't matter whether it's worth $1 or $10 million. It's the story is so precious. And so, you know, our job is, let's keep maintaining the stories. Let's do these rituals like having great car events, concours, d'elegance, those sorts of things where you honor truly great cars, and point to the next generation that, yeah, some actually do matter differently than others. And it's okay to kind of honor an object in a way that, you know, is kind of cool. And by the way, they sound cool, they look good, and they're fun to drive. We participate in thousands of events around the world, sponsor a lot of them. We create some of our own that are kind of small touring events, if you can imagine, but we just said, hey, wait a minute, there are a few of these larger events that if we could kind of put them together in more of a little galaxy of events that, you know, keep their local character and flavor, but, you know, have some scale behind them and have some of the, you know, economies that we could bring to it, that this is part of our mission. We got to save car culture, not just driving.
And you have these media initiatives that include not only the shows, not only the drive-throughs, but you have the Hagerty Magazine, which I think is over 600,000 subscribers now.
Almost 700,000, yeah.
All right, and YouTube channel. All right, over 1 million.
Almost 2 million. Approaching 2 million by the end of summer, I hope.
As I was going to say, there's exponential growth, yeah, faster than they're printed in the bios and the information I'm looking at. What have you learned from these efforts, if anything at all?
Well, you know, automotive media is an interesting side because for us to do what we want to do, we have to be really good at media and information and make it entertaining. Because even if deep down underneath a lot of what we do, we do love to sell a lot of insurance for people who really like cars. That's not a fun topic to talk about. I've tried for 30 years, and it's just hard to make it a sexy moment. But people love talking about cars, and their interest in cars, and all the stuff around it. So media was going to be a big piece of what we do. You know, unfortunately, traditional automotive media, the you know, the big companies out there, the magazines, I grew up reading Car and Driver and Road and Track, and I was a Porsche guy, so Porsche Panorama. Those business models are kind of broken from what they once were. You know, the subscription, you know, model, people hardly pay for it anymore. They're trying to be very advertising driven, you know, and that's why you see some of our beloved magazines kind of get thinner and thinner and maybe not as high quality. And for us, the way we approach it is that, you know, when you can join our Hagerty Drivers Club, it's, you know, $50 a year. You get a lot of features, but you get this magazine. And we just decided, let's keep doing it the way it really needs to be done. Let's bring in A-level talent, you know, best of the best to write and produce and great photography. And we knew that there was an audience for it, and they're rewarding us by saying, yep, we like it. And that's why, you know, Hagerty Drivers Club now is the second highest circulation car magazine in the world by an audited circ basis. And that means nothing other than if it just helps us save driving and car culture, that's perfect. Fits our mission.
I got to take a quick break, and we'll be back. I want to talk to you a little bit more about electrification, the younger generation, and we'll get it all in, I hope. This is Brembo Red. We'll be back after this.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the 2021 Concours d'Elegance of America here in Plymouth, Michigan, where we're spending some time with McKeel Haggerty, CEO of Haggerty Insurance, which is now the new owner of this beautiful car show. McKeel, we were talking earlier about the younger generation and how to make sure we keep them interested in cars. But are you really that optimistic that we can keep the younger generation as interested as the past two or three generations have been? And those are the guys actually that created this beautiful show.
It's the biggest question we all have. You know, the evidence is that young people do like cars, maybe not in the same percentage of the population that they did a previous generation before, but a large number, you know, tens of millions of young people like them. They interact with cars differently. You know, there are a lot of modern cars that aren't maybe as appealing, but there's some that are just awesome, right? I mean, and we had a great panel here today of, you know, kind of the golden age of the muscle car back 1970, 71, but really we're in a new golden age of muscle cars right now with all these incredible, you know, high-performance cars being built by auto manufacturers that you can go right into a dealership and order and have fun with. The statistics around young people being interested in cars where they say, oh, they're not getting their driver's licenses, a lot of that was post-financial crisis data. And, you know, when you can't have a job and you got to move back into the house with mom and dad, the last thing you're thinking about is buying a cool car. But millennials, who everybody obsesses over, are now turning 40 and they're making money. And if there's anything that we've discovered is that as people become a little bit more successful financially, they tend to act more alike. They don't suddenly, you know, hit 40, make some money, and decide to become beekeepers. They tend to do the same sorts of things that their parents did. They go on vacations, and, you know, if they were in a car collecting family, they probably like cars. And so now they can afford them. And it's different the way they interact with them. Truly these next generations, because we talked earlier, the media world around it is changing. It's not as rich as it once was. So they go online. They YouTube, you know, the greatest schoolhouse and crazy town ever with YouTube, but think of the video game platforms. You know, the two major video game platforms that are in a lot of people's houses, even if you don't have a lot of money, are, you know, you have Gran Turismo on the Sony PlayStation and you have Forza on the Xbox. And those platforms have like over 10 million people playing them on just those automotive games on a global basis. Numbers that would just make almost anybody blush. And that's how they're interacting with cars. And so, yes, they like electronics. Yes, they have to be able to make money to afford them. But I'm not actually worried. It's just going to change, and our job is to be there for them when they're ready.
You know, I was looking in your bio, and I see you spent a lot of time with the younger generation from a leadership standpoint. You've been very active in the YPO, the Young Presidents Organization. Why did you get involved in that? And tell me a little bit about what you've learned from that organization.
Well, you know, I when I dropped out of grad school thinking I was going to be a philosophy professor and then found myself selling insurance, is that I didn't have a business education and there was not a chance I was ever going to go back and get an MBA or anything like that. So I needed to shortcut my growth. I discovered, you know, there are a lot of these entrepreneurial groups and YPO was kind of a magic home for me because it was this group of CEOs who looked at their whole life, not just their business. It wasn't just about making money. It was, you know, I can have a good personal life and I can have a good family life and I can grow a good business. And they're all kind of intertwined. When those things are all kind of healthy, it makes everything work a little bit differently. So it's not a get rich quick club. It's a get become a better person group. And that really appealed to me. And what I learned is this, you know, kind of idea of the growth mindset, which is, it doesn't matter what your background is, it doesn't matter where you got your degrees, it doesn't matter anything, is you're not a finished product. You know, as a human being, you get to learn and grow and become something else, whatever you want to be. And that just really appealed to me and got really involved with the organization. I ended up getting on the International Board of Directors. I was chairman of the board of YPO globally 2016 and 17 and traveled all over the world. And this idea, I just saw it replicated all over the world and, you know, met entrepreneurs and a lot of leaders, and I brought it back to the business, and hopefully it left my mark out there too. So,
you know, I think that's something I think in leadership, a lot of us sometimes forget. They're so focused on the runway, you know, and taking off, that they forget about becoming more well-rounded. And, you know, some of the best guys that I've ever worked for and worked with were people who not only were focused on the business, but were focused on other things. So it's like, well, what else do you do? You know, and that's really what I think rounds out great leaders.
Well, I think so. You know, it's you know, I was, when I talk to business people about, you know, how do you grow your business, is I'll ask them things like, well, what's the human truth around your business? You know, I know our human truth around Hagerty is that there are these cars and there are people who love them. I didn't invent the cars and I didn't invent their love for it. It's just, that's the human connection. It's a human truth. It's not an economic truth that somebody loves cars. It's this human truth. So my job is just to tap into that.
Aren't those cars human? I always thought the cars were human.
Well, anyway. They do smile at you.
Well, McKeel, I probably could go another 3 hours with you here on the podcast, and I think we'd have a lot of fun doing it. But I appreciate you stopping by on a extremely busy weekend here at Concours. I wish you the best of luck with the show, and thanks for giving some insight on Hagerty's strategy in the future.
You bet. Thanks for being here. We'll see you down the road somewhere.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Brembo Red. Stay with us as Michael Robinette, Executive Director of IHS Automotive, joins us here at the Concours to explain what in the world is going on with the new car market, all those empty dealer lots nationwide, microchips, electric cars. He has all the answers right after this quick break.
Why should you trust Brembo Brakes? Because 60 years of racing, testing, braking, and bettering. Because dogs in the road, indecisive squirrels, and that kid chasing the lost ball. Because tiny humans in the back seat and blind turns in front of you. Because every car should be equipped with the same kind of performance, safety, and comfort that manufacturers and professional drivers trust every day. Visit buybrembo.com and learn more about the most trusted brakes in braking.
Welcome back to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg.
We're back at the 2021 Concours Elegance of America event here in Plymouth, Michigan. It is a spectacular car show. These are the days, to be honest with you, I don't think there's a better job than we have in the automotive business when you can spend a Sunday, a beautiful Sunday, as a matter of fact. Don't ask me about last night when the weather went crazy, but it is beautiful here. And these kind of events, I have to tell you, bring out a who's who in the automotive industry. And one of those who's is Michael Robinette, who's sitting in front of me. He's the executive director with IHS Market Automotive Advisory Practice. This guy knows his stuff. He knows everything about the automotive industry, and he actually has an opinion on where we're going. So, Michael, thank you for stopping by and joining us on Brembo Red.
Thank you, Dan. It's great, and I've been coming to this event for a number of years now, and their ability to pivot after some unbelievable weather last night is really something else, to be honest with you. So hats off to the Concours people.
Unfortunately, we got like 8 inches of rain in the last week, and the course was a sponge. And they said, forget it, we got to move all the cars around. So they moved them into hard surface areas, moved all our booths around, and they didn't decide to do it until like last night at 10 o'clock. So imagine 280 cars I think they have this year, and they moved them all around. Did a great job.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you got a tough job. All these auto guys got a tough job. So the first thing I want to ask you about is to explain to our audience how come they can't get a car when they go to a dealer. They're telling them 6 months, 7 months wait. This microchip thing, can you first of all explain what's happening?
Sure.
And is it ever going to get better?
It actually started couple of years ago. The genesis of all these chip issues really started a couple of years ago, almost quietly, like unfortunately like some sort of disease that people don't know is really kind of fermenting in their body. And to be honest with you, what happened is as we got to the towards the end of last year, a couple of vehicle manufacturers starting to notice, you know, when they were dealing with the chip manufacturers, that their orders were coming back with really strong volumes, and the chip manufacturers are pushing back. Well, I don't have all that capacity, and it really happened back in COVID, back in March of, you know, basically 2020, when the industry basically said, hey, we don't need all those chips, and the chip manufacturer said, are you sure about this? And they said, well, yeah, we're sure. And I don't want to peanut butter everybody. I think you've got a situation where the Detroit 3 And again, I don't want to pinpoint it, but there's been a subset of manufacturers that have been more hit by this, and they would even tell you. So make a long story short, I think that the industry has quickly realized just how important the chips are. The fact that the types of chips that the chip manufacturers are investing in are much smaller, more complex. And those aren't the types that the automotive industry uses. Automotive industry uses chips that in 10 years you could have a vehicle in the middle of Alaska and start it up and it's not going to be a problem. Just the ruggedness and the durability of the chips that are required for automotive are on a different level than what's in our cell phone or in our PS5 or whatever the case is.
So at the end of the day, these guys got cut short, right? I mean, it's a supply and demand issue, right?
And the margins that the consumer sector was paying was a lot higher.
So you got all these guys sitting at home, right, in COVID, ordering a lot of electronics, yeah. And at the same time, the auto industry goes out of business for 2 months last year.
Essentially.
And they stopped their orders, and that capacity shifted, and now we got to catch up. Everybody's got to catch up. And my understanding is, too, that you cannot invest in this capacity. It doesn't, you just don't go out and buy a chip machine, right? This takes a year to get in place, right?
And it's various levels. So you've got what we call silicon foundries. So these huge, immense factories, and you literally grow silicon to basically make a chip. So it's not the type of thing that you and I in our garage could figure, hey, we'll make some extra money growing chips. It has to be all clean room. It's all special water. I mean, it's just incredible the amount of work that goes into this, and it's years in the making. So it's kind of like the Titanic. We moved, and then we got to slowly move back, and the industry is learning some very valuable supply chain lessons. Even 120 years later, finally learning some lessons here.
I think just in time, at least in the chip area, isn't going to work quite like they thought it was going to work.
No, you can't buy chips like you're buying washers from Grainger. You just don't do it that way. It has to be a much more contemplative, much more longer-term situation. And I think the vehicle manufacturers admittedly are making those adjustments, but it's going to take some time.
All right, next question I'm going to ask you is how much time? Because people want to know, when are we going to get back to normal?
I'll be honest. I think the industry is surprised literally every day with new announcements, and we've heard from various manufacturers that the safety stock is down to zero. And that should tell you everything you need to know. If the safety stock is down to zero, then basically we're not going to know in very much advance notice how often we're going to have to take a plant down. Our feeling at IHS Market is that throughout the second half, it's going to slowly get better, but slowly is the operative word. And into next year, we're still going to have some problems probably in the first half of next year, sporadic problems. Smarter OEMs are redeploying their chips to the more profitable vehicles. But, you know, every vehicle is down to 20, 25, 30-day supply. So when the industry feels that they've got enough chips, they're just going to tell the suppliers, hey, time to ramp it all up. But the suppliers don't have enough labor. They've got resin issues. They've got steel issues. They've got all kinds of supply issues. So I think that these supply chain issues are going to be with us through 22, to be completely honest.
Yeah, I probably would agree with you. You know, when you look at it from a businessman's standpoint, you say the auto industry runs really, really well from a cash management standpoint and everything else. But when you get into this situation, you're not going to run well. I mean, it's going to take time to wind it back up again.
Just in terms of logistics issues are incredible right now. Not being able to find containers to bring stuff over from Asia, nor find a slot on a ship. I was talking to a client the other day that's in non-automotive, and they're saying they can't even find the ability to get on a ship to get their stuff over from Asia. So again, these are short-term issues, but they continue to basically collapse upon one another. I don't think the inventory is going to get back up to where we need it to be, probably, to be honest with you, 23. If you're a well-run supplier, this is going to be a very challenging late 21 through 22. But ones that aren't well-run are going to be opportunities for those suppliers that are well-run from an acquisition perspective.
All right, let's look at something very interesting. A lot of gas-powered cars here, right? Going all
Love
the way
it.
Back to the war.
Love it.
Did you see anything that really piqued your interest?
Oh, I think there are a couple of offerings. I'm an old Mopar guy, so there were a couple of mid-60s. A couple of Valiants, there was a Coronet. I just love, I love how the industry in the 50s had this huge canvas. You know, vehicles were, you know, largest vehicles were 22 feet long, and they could do so many things with those vehicles. And then in the 60s, the vehicles started to slim up a little bit. just a little bit, and they had to do more with less. And just the expressive designs, and I was walking with, around with a friend of mine, and you know, front ends are wonderful, but I was looking at instrument panels, how much they were just so different back then. And then now, today's instrument panels, you know, it's just a bunch of screens, and with very little switchgear, but in the traditional days, you know, 30, 40 years ago, just so different. And then the back ends of vehicles, just to see how expressive the bumpers and lighting systems were back then, were just something else. And it's difficult going forward to do that.
All right, sit here for a couple minutes. We're going to go make some money, and we'll be back after this. We'll talk a little bit about electrics, and are they real? Are we really going to be driving electric cars in the next 4 or 5 years? All that stuff. We'll talk about it in just a minute. Michael Robinette here with us from IHS. Stay with us. We got more stuff to talk about.
Okay, man, this is your time. Maybe you didn't choose this, but you're here now. You're going to go out there and be an all-star caregiver. Cook, clean, be there emotionally and physically. You got to dig deeper. Drive them to physical therapy, doctor's appointments, because that's what caregivers do. Don't give up. Show the world that you're tougher than tough. Caregiving is tougher than tough. Find the care guides you need at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We're at the 2021 Concours d'Elegance of America here in Plymouth, Michigan. And on the grass with me right now is Michael Robinette from IHS. And Michael, really, he knows a lot about the auto industry. And I have to tie him down a little bit and say, forget about all these gas-powered cars you see here out on the lawn. Supposedly, we are going to be driving electric cars. And some say within the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to see a huge influx. Some say 10 years. Some say 15 years. What saith you, Michael Robinette, about market share in the electrics?
You get right down to it, don't you?
I do. Get right to it.
All right. Well, if we look at how we've electrified so far and what's expected over the next couple of years, we've electrified on the edges. We've electrified luxury. We've done some performance. We've done, you know, basically on the edges of the segments. And now we're starting to look at, you know, you see these larger investment announcements by Volkswagen and by General Motors and by Ford and a host of others that are going into electrification. And what are they doing? They're electrifying the middle of the market. They're going after mid-sized crossover utilities. They're doing some small, but mostly what we call in the industry CD segment size crossovers. And that's where they feel that they're the only way we're going to drive any volume in terms of BEV, battery electric vehicles, is really from the middle. Because on the edges, we're able to do, you know, 50 to 100,000 pickup trucks, and you've got your Teslas of the world and your Rivians. But a lot of these, and again, doing a great job, mostly on the edges. The only way we drive any volume is in the middle. So that's what, frankly, the industry is looking at, because the emissions legislation in China, and also, as we all know, in Europe, is moving very, very swiftly. And to a point where internal combustion engine is going to have trouble meeting any compliance targets by 2030, 2035 in those regions. North America is a smaller part of the global framework than we used to be. We used to be 25% of total production, maybe 30% when China wasn't around. Now China is a third of global production, and we're the smaller guy on the block. We're 15%. We're going to have trouble in North America keeping any level of economies of scale if we don't follow the rest of the world. I know people don't want to hear about that if they want to keep internal combustion engine. We are going to keep it a little bit longer than most other regions, but at some point it is going to go. The real key is how do we get the cost out of BEVs, improve the infrastructure, add a better charging network or a more and, you know, a more comprehensive charging network, and electrify the middle of the market. That's the only way this happens.
You know, I see that, and you see a lot of announcements now on electric cars. And again, that's going to be cars that are coming out in the next 2-3 years.
Right.
So, and they're all in that 45 plus at minimum. I mean, minimum. Most of them are even higher than
right.
that. So I don't see a lot of announcements in that middle market. So I agree with you. But then the question becomes, I mean, you're talking infrastructure. You're talking new cars that are in the middle of the market. And then they've got these guys who are going to say, you know, the market's going to be heavily electric by 2030. That can't all happen in that time period, can it?
I love to do backwards math.
Okay.
We're in the middle of 2021. So basically 2030 is 8.5 years from now. If you think about the way that the cycles work in the vehicle industry, where every 5-year cycle, basically we've only got 1.5 cycles until we have to go, quote unquote, to some much larger portion of BEV in the market. Even the aspirational announcements by 2035 by some very large vehicle manufacturers have said, hey, we want to be BEV by 2035. They're aspirational. I'm not saying that it's not going to happen, but and they're moving in that direction. But I think we all know, like in some of the real key segments, like full-size pickup truck, anybody who watches something like Yellowstone will say, how in the heck are you going to electrify, you know, all these Dodge Rams out in the middle of the Montana outback or out the ranch area? So I think, you know, the urban areas, suburban areas, there's definitely the ability to do that. Long-range travel is going to be a bit more difficult. Hydrogen at some point, not in the next 5 years, but probably 10, 15, and 20, is going to find a way into that infrastructure somehow.
Are our electric vehicles the Betamax of the future here? Do we have the wrong technology? Is it really hydrogen that's going to inch its way into this market and become the technology?
It's funny. I would call it more the VHS of the market, to be honest with you, and I'll tell you why. I think you need battery electric technology to really enable hydrogen. Because what is hydrogen? It's a fuel cell stack driving electric motors to get your vehicle from A to B. That's got hydrogen that's feeding the fuel cell stack. So if you think about it, a lot of the technologies we need for battery electric are going to be required for hydrogen anyway. So I look at it as more of a little bit of a linear travel and not so much and or if. I think it's along a continuum.
Whether you believe we need electrics, don't need electrics and everything else, it's obviously the market is going that way. If we're going to do it anti-legislatively here in the North America, right, if there is such a word as anti-legislatively, but if we're going to do it without legislation, we got a lot of work to do, right?
Oh,
with
my
the
gosh.
Infrastructure, with to be honest with you, with selling it to the consumers, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think anybody with, frankly, that is somewhat realistic knows that the government has to be part of the equation, whether it be through incentives with the vehicle manufacturers, incentives with the customers, incentives to drive a much more comprehensive charging network, and even having the available power. Those are still some bridges that we have to cross. Now, we don't need it right now, but at some point, if the timeline we're looking at is going to come true, we need it within the next 8 to 10 years. And therefore, you know, some folks that really understand the infrastructure better get moving.
You know, I look at this, all the power companies, right, have been doing things for years to get us to save power, right? I mean, they come out, fix your shower head, do all this stuff to stop using gas, stop using electricity and everything else. And then we're going to go out and get two big electric cars we're going to be charging every single night. You know, it seems to be somewhat anti-intuitive, but it really means to me that these electric companies are going to have to start looking at how are they going to generate electricity.
And unfortunately have to do it in a much more sustainable fashion, because sustainability is a major driver. If I look at my own personal situation, just redid my garage. What did I do before I redid my garage? I brought 100 amp service into it.
Absolutely.
I know at some point I'm going to need a car charger in my garage, even if my vehicle or my house is saleable. So
let me ask you this. How are we going to continue to have great shows like we're having here and get the younger generation here? I mean, obviously, you know, you and I got a few more miles on us. We'll still come to these shows. How do we get the younger generation to still love their cars?
You know, what is going to differentiate tomorrow's vehicle? That's what's going to drive younger millennial consumers back into the market and really love their vehicles. So for our perspective, what differentiated vehicles for us? It was horsepower. It was styling. It was capability, maybe some certain convenience factors. It was a little bit of image. I think those same factors are going to be with a BEV vehicle in the future are still going to be around. But let's face it, a battery is a battery. So, I've got a bigger battery, smaller battery. Nobody's going to care. It's going to be a matter of what your performance is, what your range is, but also the design of the vehicle and the styling. Sustainability is going to be a drawing card. It's just going to be a different world. It won't be tomorrow. It won't be 5 years from now. But at some point, when I'm 80, we'll be going to a car show looking at some BEVs. I don't know if I'm looking forward to it, but it is what it is.
Well, there's hope for us, I guess, yet. There's still car guys out there. There's got to be. And there's got to be some car kids, too, I hope.
I hope so.
Michael Robinette, Executive Director of IHS Market, thanks so much for stopping by, giving us that knowledgeable insight that we're all looking for. It's going to be a tough couple years, I think, as we get back out of these problems that we're having with microchips. Anyway, always a pleasure to spend time talking about the car business with you, especially on a day like this at the Concours d'Elegance in Plymouth. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Dan.
And thanks again to McKeel Haggerty, CEO of Haggerty Insurance, for joining us on the first segment of Brembo Red. You know, we're going to have some more great guests from the Concours d'Elegance here in Plymouth, Michigan, on the next couple episodes of Brembo Red, from the Enthusiast of the Year to Collector of the Year, and we'll get some insider auto talk from deep inside the automakers. It's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. So please subscribe to Brembo Red wherever you get your podcasts. This is Dan Sandberg from Brembo North America. Take care, and I'll see you soon.
You've been listening to Brembo Red with your host, Dan Sandberg. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to podcast@us.brembo.com. Brembo Red is produced and copyrighted by Brembo North America.